We begin our show today with a remarkable story. In fact, that is the title, The Redemption of Bobby Love, a story of faith, family, and justice. And the two people who are intricately involved in this story and the authors of the book, Bobby and Cheryl Love, are joining us. And good morning to you, Bobby and Cheryl.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, Bobby, it's a story largely about you. You had a youth that was filled with controversy and, in some cases, criminality, and you got past that and thought you had it behind you, and then it resurfaced, and it was news to your beautiful wife, Cheryl. And tell us, first of all, about what happened when you were a young man and how this shaped the man you are today.
All right. Well, as a young man, we were, living in the South, Jim Crow South, and just doing the best we could to get by. My mother and I had eight siblings. We would, have fun. We would, enjoy ourselves around the kitchen table. But in time, the streets was, pulling at me because of places I wanted to go. And I finally last succumbed to that.
And ultimately, you were arrested for armed robbery, correct?
Yes, that was further down the line after I had lived in North Carolina, lived in Washington, D.C., and back and forth I was doing crime, and then I got busted in North Carolina.
You're from Greensboro, North Carolina, and Cheryl's from Brooklyn. And how did the two of you meet?
We met at work. Cheryl tells the story of how I used to sing, and I was calling it being, making my time go fast as I'm washing pots and cleaning up and doing stuff like that,
Okay, when you say at work, Bobby, where were you working in what city?
I was in New York. I was here in Brooklyn working at our Baptist Medical Center. It was a nursing home and hospital. And we worked in the kitchen together.
And you have this relationship, which is still going, and you've been through some stuff, but you probably didn't tell Cheryl the full story about your past.
No, I didn't. As I learned Cheryl a lot, got to know her a lot better, and, our relationships evolved, and, we kept building it. I realized and I noticed how brutally honest Cheryl is about everything. And I know she would have told me to turn myself in. And going back to prison just wasn't something that was on my bucket list.
Well, the setup for the story is, what's your name? Bobby Love. No, your real name. Caught between the FBI and NYPD at his Brooklyn apartment with his shocked wife, Cheryl, and children looking on, Bobby realized that after nearly 40 years, his secret was out. Bobby Love, the respected Sunday school teacher and Little League coach, was an escapee from prison for armed robbery. It was impossible for Cheryl to believe this about the man she had loved and stood by for decades, and yet suddenly, everything made sense. Cheryl, tell us about your reaction when this revelation happened all at once.
Right. So you can imagine I was totally shocked, tears, crying, screaming, all these things going on when the police came in and one of the officers said to me as I opened the door, "Stand back, ma'am. You don't know who this gentleman, you don't know who this man is." And I'm like, "What?" And even as I say it now, it just makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck because all these years I had kind of felt that Bobby was hiding something from me and not telling me something, but I had no idea what was about to go down, And so I'm looking at my husband, but he's not looking at me when they're saying that. And I'm like, "Bobby, what's going on? Did you kill somebody? What happened?" And, he's just got his head down, not really talking. He had his head down, and I saw the cops were behind him, and I couldn't really hear. I couldn't hear what he was saying. I couldn't hear what the cops were saying. So mind you, I still don't know that his name is not Bobby Love. So that was some warning.
The book from Cheryl and Bobby is The Redemption of Bobby Love. a dramatic, true account of an escaped convict and his wife of 35 years who never knew his secret. The story, as you can imagine, captured the imagination of millions in New York, but also it is now a story for all of us to absorb in this book. Now, what was the next step after this raid at the house? So, Cheryl, what happened after that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so like I said, they just said that they were going to take my husband in, and I didn't, like, I still didn't know, but they had also said to him, they asked him his name, as he tells me, they said, what's your name? And he says, Bobby Love. And they said, no, what's your real name? And he says, Walter Curtis Miller. And so from there now, I'm still not hearing it. And I'm trying to get cookies and things to him, something to eat, because he's a diabetic and, you know, they're getting ready to take him out of here. And I'm really not knowing what's going on. And the office is still trying to hold me back. But I'm saying to him, you know, my husband, he's a diabetic. He needs his medicine. And they let him have cookies, a couple of cookies and everything, but they put the handcuffs on him, not right in the house, but on the outside of the house. And they told him he could speak to his son and his kids that were there, our daughter and our son. And I just remember how my son was just standing there looking like in silence, you know. And one of the officers said to him, as they even had took Bobby out, he said, son, continue to go to school. He said, your father's not a bad guy. He said, just you do the right thing, okay? And he said that to my son, our son. And so, you know, they went on and took him on out, and they did allow him to hug the kids and everything and say goodbye to me. And Bobby also said, Cheryl, this happened before you. This happened before the children, you know, and they just took him on out. So that's what I remember. So they also called me back that day, and Bobby called me. They let him call me, and he told me that they had took him to Bellevue Hospital, and they gave him his medicine, and so he had his medicine. But they also had a lawyer call me, and she said to me, okay, Mrs. Love, after she spoke to me, she said, I want you, when you go and see Mr. Love, I want you to say Walter Curtis Miller when you say, and I said, okay. And I said, is that the name of the facility he's in? And she got so quiet, you could hear crickets. And me and my daughter was right there. And when I got off the phone, immediately when I hung up, something just came over me. And I was like, oh, Jesse, that's your father's name. That's his real name. And that's how it came to me that was his name. Because I started thinking, his sister's name is Jean Miller Levesque. And I said, oh, my God, his name is Walter Curtis Miller. So that's how I found out about his name. Mm-hmm.
Well, Bobby, yep. How did it turn out? You're with Cheryl now, but it took some doing to get back together, didn't it?
Yes, it did. When she was able to see me over at Rutgers for the first time, we had a conversation about her, you know, whether she was going to leave me or whether she was going to divorce me. And she said, no, she was with me. She was 100% behind me. The kids were saying things they shouldn't be saying. But everything was looking up, and I had full confidence, you know, that, you know, we're going to get through this. However long it takes, we're going to get through this.
How long did it take?
Well, I was sent back down to North Carolina. I spent 6 months over at Rutgers Island. Then I was sent back down to North Carolina. And I was paroled in October, and I didn't get the actual parole until January. And I came back here to New York in January, and I've been out and here in New York since.
You know, I had to come to the realization of you know, my husband had deceived me. This man who I had been with all these years had deceived me. But I had to come to the fact that everybody has a past. And Bobby was a good man. He was doing the things he was supposed to do. He worked 2 and 3 jobs. You know, he had was very remorseful for the things that he had done and had told me, if, you know, you want to leave, sure, you can leave. But our faith in God.
Well, the book is The Redemption of Bobby Love. This trouble began when Bobby was around 14 years old, and he has lived to talk about it and is living an exemplary life and has quite a story to tell. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. In just a moment, we're going to be joined by Sasha Cabalshaw and Dana Winbush. They're involved in fighting crime in our community. About 4 months ago, a group started called the Baton Rouge Community Street Team. But we're finishing up with Bobby and Cheryl Love. The book is The Redemption of Bobby Love. Bobby's secret was out. As a black child from the Jim Crow South, he found himself with limited options and legal trouble before he was 14 years old. He became a master thief. He soon found himself facing a 30-year prison sentence. Bobby outwitted his jailers. He escaped, fled to New York, changed his name, started a new life as Bobby Love. And during that time, he worked multiple jobs to support his wife and their growing family, coached Little League, attended church, led a normal life. But it all came crashing down. And with the drama of a jailbreak story and the incredible tension of a life lived in hiding, The Redemption of Bobby Love shows what it's like to build a life from scratch. The pain of festering secrets, the truth about forgiveness, and the unbreakable bonds of love and faith that keep a family together. And Cheryl, you were saying that, of course, you gave it a thought to leave him, but ultimately you decided to stay. What was the main reason why you did not leave him when the long arm of the law came to your house?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had to, like I said, come to realization of, listen, girl, this man has deceived you for these years. But I had to outweigh the good and the bad of it all. And I didn't know Walter Curtis Miller or the things that he did. I knew what Bobby Love did and what he did for me and the family and how I loved him and how he loved me. I mean, marriage, it was good, it was bad. We had good times and bad times, you know, but we got through those things. But there was always, I always felt like there was something that he wasn't telling me. I even had said to him, I asked him, did he have another family somewhere? Because sometimes Bobby would get isolated and not really conversate with me, you know, communicate with me. So I took that as being a little off. I took also, he didn't like to take pictures much. Very seldom did he take a picture, and he really didn't like it. And so that kind of made me think, why you don't like to take pictures? Mm-hmm. But then I talked to people at my church. I talked to my girlfriends, and they were like, girl, are you kidding me? This man works 2 and 3 jobs. Bobby is here with you. He does go shopping. Bobby irons clothes because my daughters would have beautiful uniforms. He ironed everything so beautifully. You know, he was everything I wanted. But it was just that I would even have this recurring dream of this rope, thick rope coming out of his mouth. And that just let me know, this man, he's not telling me something. But he was treating me well. He was treating the children well. He worked. So I just went with it, you know.
Well, it is quite a story. And Bobby, you've been back from the abyss a couple of times, and congratulations on keeping your life and your family together. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. Keep going. And we're joined in studio now by Sasha Cabalshaw and Dana Winbush. They were on the front page of the Baton Rouge Advocate a couple of days ago, members of the Baton Rouge Community Street Team. They are fighting crime in our community, and the city broke its record for homicides last year. It's on pace to see more record, even more this year. And a story that broke this morning, the nationwide murder rate was up 30% last year, 30%, the highest gain in the history of the United States by a good margin in more than 100 years of record keeping. But Sasha and Dana, they're going to places that many would not dare go. They going to Eden Park, Estruma, Greenville Extension, Midtown, Smiley Heights, Fairfields, Melrose East, and they're trying to make this a better place at some risk to themselves. This is not something that is done without risk at all, as most good endeavors in life are. You've got to take chances, and doing it in the pandemic age as well. Sashika, who's longtime radio personality, by the way, and for many years was our producer of this show. And good morning to you.
Thank you. Good morning, Jim. It's good to be back.
Well, it's good to see your smiling face. And what a voice and what a talent. You've spent your life here. And as we know, there is a side to Baton Rouge that's not so pleasant, and you're getting right there in the middle of it. Why did you do it?
Well, just wanted to help. I've been, you know, in the community, like you said, as a radio personality over the last couple decades. And my initial goal was, how can I help? How can I be a part of this initiative? And while, you know, the kinks and everything was getting worked out, you know, we went through some extensive trainings and interviews, and they saw fit that I was able to be on the street team. So
Now you're going door to door, and when I look at these people, there aren't that many on the street team, right? How many are there?
So we have six right now.
Six. So you're two of the six. One third of the street team is in the house. And you're women, and you're in a danger zone. And by the way, this is an initiative from the mayor's office, and you have the blessing from the mayor's office. But do you go knock on doors?
So we don't necessarily knock on doors. So we pretty much meet the community where they are. So if they're outside on their front porch, if they're fixing, working on cars, walking their dog, whatever it may be, we approach them in that way.
And what kind of a message are you conveying? Are you asking them questions? Are you getting information? What are you doing?
So we're introducing ourselves and just letting them know that we are here to help provide resources. We are here in the community to try to de-escalate any situation before it arises. We're here to actually partner with them. We're here to partner with the community. So we want them to actually be a part of what it is that we do voluntarily, whatever it may be. So as far as asking questions and things like that, the only questions we ask are the needs. What are the needs in your community? As far as if there's blighted property, if there's crime taking place on your street, how can you, as a resident on this particular street, help with eliminating that crime? And some of them will say, you know, I'll go out and talk to whoever it may be to try to de-escalate the situation.
Now, some people live in fear, and for good reason. And these are good people who live in a bad spot, and they're reluctant to talk to just anybody. How do you get them to open up, Dana?
Well, we just give them direct eye contact, using our experiences in life, period, just talking with them, making them feel comfortable with us.
Now, we do have people that see us and take off running because they think that we're the police, and we're not associated with the police in that sense of, you know, hey, we're here to find out stuff. Like, we're no.
But people might think that, and if they think that, you could be in danger yourself.
Yes.
And yet you're still doing this.
Because we want to help. This is what we...
Well, that's admirable. Mm-hmm. But it is a dangerous community in some spots, and you're going right to these spots that supposedly are some of the most dangerous.
And Dana is in charge of mapping out our spots. And so she chooses what she calls hot zones. And I'll let Dana tell you why.
How is a hot zone designated?
It's designated by the crime stats. Mostly, like if there's been murders that has occurred within the last week or two or in the last month, or historical areas that have been high in crime. So I'm a product of 70802, pretty familiar with that area. I'm going to walk in the streets and meet my people where they are. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've had Chris Andrews on this show a few times, the reverend who does work in these areas. And generally, there's no issue. It's like any other part of town. You could run into the wrong person at the wrong time in any place, as has happened to me. But nonetheless, some people are saying, are you kidding me? Going right into 70802? What are you thinking? Who's giving you the advice to do this? But you're putting caution to the side. And as I say, that's commendable. Do you feel at risk at all?
Well, I mean, every time you walk out your door, it's a risk. So being that 70802, 70805 are the piloted zip codes chosen because of the crime rate, we know what we're getting into.
877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. Back after this with Sasha Gabalshaw and Dana Winbush. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing an in-house and studio. Sasha Gabalshaw, veteran radio personality and now a part of the Baton Rouge Community Street Team, along with her partner Dana Winbush. They are the team leaders going door-to-door, talking with people in some of the hot zones in our community, characterized as hot spots. And the story that was in The Advocate a few days ago, the grant application argued poverty, disinvestment, lack of education, limited jobs, and disempowerment are what's driving crime in the neighborhoods. As one possible solution, the team that has evolved from the city is the Baton Rouge Community Street Teams Unit. And you may be able to get information that others can't. You're not wearing a badge. I don't think you're armed, which, of course, some people would say is good. Others would say not so good. But what do people tell you? What are their major concerns?
The major concerns in the neighborhoods that we're seeing are crime, basically. A lot of our youth are dying. Gun violence is really taking over the streets in some of the 70802, 70805 zip codes and all around Baton Rouge. But basically, they want to be safer in their homes. And we're trying to provide resources to those children by giving them access to better education, mm-hmm. Even mentoring them, as well as job placement. Things like that, because it's been proven that if they have all of this, crime will drop.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in this segment with Sasha Gabalshaw and Dana Winbush, Baton Rouge Community Street Team, HB and Denham Springs. You're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning, HB.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can. You're on the air, HB. All right. Sounds like see if we can get him back, Alondra. I don't know what's going on, but HB obviously had a question. I know he's a former police officer. And are you working hand in glove with law enforcement?
So we are with law enforcement as far as, you know, working with them. They pretty much gave us their blessing. Chief Paul gave us his blessing to pretty much do the work that we are doing in the community. So he is excited that we're here in the community. But we realize as the Baton Rouge Community Street Team that you cannot arrest your way out of this problem of gun violence. And so we are here pretty much before that situation happens. We're here to try to defuse bombs. We use protocols and procedures, standard operating procedures and guidelines and things like that to be able to help us strategize in the work that we do in the community.
A listener asked, how is this similar to Brave, the program that preceded this one? Are there some comparisons? Do you know much about Brave?
So we don't have police walking with us at all. Our team is made up of residents and citizens in the community. And, most of our team, they are from backgrounds of working with their own organizations. For instance, we have Ms. Liz Robinson with Change. Her son was taken, his life was taken by gun violence. And so she's a part of our organization. We have Miss Renetta Bell. She's a behavioral health, psychologist, counselor. You know, she's everything when it comes to that. And so, you know, Greg Phillips, he's also been mentoring young men and so on and so on. And so and I, with my organization, Outstanding Mature Girls, you know, mentoring youth. So, you know, we're all coming together to make this work happen and make it possible. So, no, we don't have police. None of our backgrounds are in law enforcement or anything like that.
I remember Jesse Jackson coming through here 37 years ago, and his mantra was keep hope alive. And then others after him used that, including President Obama. But hope is a great thing, but sometimes people lose hope amid these kinds of situations. Are these people desperate, Dana?
Oh, they're desperate, but it's become the norm to them. This is what we're seeing across the 70802, 70805 zip code. So we're just there to provide these resources to them, to focus on the prevention of crime, and also just to let them know that, being that we are from those zones, those 70802 area codes, that, you know, there's always a positive way to go about life in those areas.
How much of this is related to race? You're in a zone which is almost all black people. And as I stated, most of these people are law-abiding citizens. They play by the rules, and yet they have to live in fear. And they see things, young kids see people on the streets dead and gone, friends of theirs sometimes, family members. How much does race play in this?
Well, I know right now, you know, gun violence is the leading cause of death for black males ages 15 to 24. And, you know, that's our target. And, I mean, it is what it is. It's real life. And, you know, this is what our community is experiencing at this time. And that's just so happened to be, you know, the highest race in those particular communities. But violence is everywhere. It's everywhere.
How was it for you growing up in this community?
So for me, growing up, so I did not grow up in the 70802, 70805, but as a radio personality, those are my listeners. Those are the people that I influenced while I was on air. And so being that, I mean, I went to school at University Terrace, I lived in Gardier, you know, in those particular areas, and, you know, Sherwood. You know, where Dana grew up, I didn't grow up over there, but I know where I grew up, I experienced, mm-hmm. you know, those things as far as gun violence, domestic violence, and, you know, just everything. So my experiences are able to help me, you know, when I'm on the streets, because I can definitely, you know, relate in that sense.
Dana, you went to school where?
Capitol High.
Capitol High, right in the heart of all this.
Correct. And a little area we call Easytown.
And there are a lot more people like you who came out of Capitol High than there are people in prison. But the perception by some is that everybody
right.
is involved in some kind of crime or chicanery. It's not the case, is it?
No, it's not. It's definitely not. They have taxpayers in those areas. It's just that because the kids don't have that mm-hmm. much structure, they tend to, you know, cause violence in those areas.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up, did you feel in any way disenfranchised?
In some ways. But I know that as a product of Capitol High, we were the first school to pass all four sections of the I-LEAP.
Ooh-hoo. Yeah. There you go.
We had the higher score than Baton Rouge High and Ben Franklin at the time. So, yeah, I
so
know that
a good
as a product of that 70802, where good things come out of it.
So I do have connections to Capitol High. My father-in-law was the valedictorian uh-huh. of Capitol High.
Very good.
Okay. Bonchamp.
I remember. Well, where do we go from here? This has been a tough year. And as I stated, it's been a tough year in many places in our country, but Is there reason to believe things are going to get better?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, we even see it, you know, on the streets. For example, on, you know, we went canvassing Monday, and this young man said he was just sitting on his porch and wondering how he can make a difference in the world. And we appeared. We showed up.
Yeah.
He had his Crocs on, went, changed into his tennis shoes, and he came walking with us on the streets of his neighborhood. And so just seeing that, and he, you know, he was able to introduce us to people. So, you know, we're considered credible messengers because of our work in the community. And so people like this young man, we call him, you know, LTOs. You know, he's licensed to operate in his community. So he's able to, you know, to bring us along, which he did. And we had a wonderful, wonderful canvassing that day.
All right. Zach in South Baton Rouge. Let's see if we can get Zach in. Good morning, Zach. You're on Talk Louisiana. Yes.
Good morning. Good morning. I grew up in South Baton Rouge. I grew up in the 70802. You know, I think, first of all, we have to get rid of this stigma. Yeah, things happening all over Baton Rouge. I lived in this area, in the Shenandoah area, for years, and I've seen crime like this since I've been here almost, okay? It's not always reported always, you know, on the news. But let me say this, though. Until we get rid of the stigma from 708-02-05, et cetera, and tell our...
All right, what about the stigma?
Amen.
Is that a problem?
Yes, definitely. You know, people are afraid. Businesses are afraid to develop there. You know, even though we do have some initiatives where, economically, you know, growth and things like that, people are wanting to do things in those particular areas. But I mean, just to be honest, yeah, the stigma is definitely is there. And that's what we are here for, to dispel that and to try to eradicate that that stigma.
Well, we wish you well, and we look forward to an update. Sasha Kabashaw and Dana Winbush, they're part of the Baton Rouge Community Street Team. And is this something that's going to go on for a while, or does it have a sunset? What's the plan for the team?
Oh, yeah. It's baby steps.
There you go. Well, thanks for being with us. Good to see you again, Sasha.
Thank you. Good to see you, too.
Good luck to you, Dana. We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this quick time out. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we are slated to hear in short order, and hopefully things will go according to plan, but not so far, at least not yet, with Anita Hill, Anita Faye Hill, one of the most prominent figures of the latter part of the 20th century. The year was 1991 when she testified before Congress in an attempt to derail the Supreme Court confirmation of Clarence Thomas. And Clarence Thomas, as we know, ultimately was confirmed, and almost 30 years later, he is still there. And he was a very young man, 43 years old. And he's been around for a long time on the United States Supreme Court. And he may be around for much longer. He is younger than some other members, including Justice Breyer. And he survived allegations of sexual misconduct, sexual harassment. It was a riveting confirmation hearing. Joe Biden was the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, and he didn't do a very good job keeping things under control, allowed personal attacks on Professor Hill that were unwarranted, unfair, and unabated. Arlen Specter, in particular, lacerated Anita Hill for no good reason. Others did on that panel as well. Orrin Hatch of Utah, and it was... A captivating exercise, and we have talked about it. There have been movies. Kerry Washington played Anita Hill in a well-known film a few years ago, and she remains a remarkable figure in American life. And Alondra Villarreal says we have the remarkable Anita Hill with us, and her book is Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. Good morning, Professor Hill.
Good morning.
It's great to hear your voice. It is hard to believe it's been 30.
It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, it is a pleasure. It's been almost three decades, and so those of us who saw it and heard it in 1991. Remember your tortured exercise as you were attacked viciously by members of the United States Senate from the Republican ranks and some by the public at large. After all these years, is it still the searing moment in your life? Does it resonate as much now as it did then?
You know, it's receded. I tell people it's never going to go away, but it's receded in its impact on my life. And that hasn't happened by accident. It's actually happened through a lot of work and in many ways through connecting with other victims and survivors of a whole range of behaviors that I'm calling gender violence in this book.
The book is Believing, and it is about Anita Hill's odyssey. She's a person from Lone Tree, Oklahoma, grew up in rural America and went off to Yale Law School after getting her undergraduate degree at Oklahoma State, and of course became a well-known public official and worked with Justice Thomas. And before we get to the 30 years since, I've noted on this show a few times, you actually took and passed a polygraph exam, something Justice Thomas didn't do. Why do you think, based on that alone, there was this incredible attack on you personally?
Yeah, I think that the denial of the harm of behavior like sexual harassment and sexual assault and rape really is part of our culture. And there will be people who will refuse to acknowledge the facts and any other evidence that it is a problem and that it does occur and that an individual is being truthful about their experience. Because for so many years, we have been trained and groomed to think that women lie about their experiences. Mm-hmm. And that you can't trust women to be truthful about their experiences. And we've also fed them the idea that maybe the experience wasn't so bad anyway. So we do that as sort of a psychological mechanism so that we can deal with the fact that we're not ready to address the problem.
Anita Hill is University Professor of Social Policy, Law, Women's and Gender Studies at Brandeis. After the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas, she became perhaps the leading figure in the fight for women's rights and against gender-based violence. And she writes that through the years and more than a few disappointments, trials, and errors, I've come to see gender-based violence as the literal and figurative foot on women's necks. We have yet to reckon with the full impact of the ocean of violations victims and survivors experience routinely. Far too many still cling to the familiar notions that women are at fault for their own brutalization and that gender-based violence impacts only others, not them or their loved ones or their communities, and certainly not the nation. Why are we in denial, Professor?
Oh, because we know as a nation that we have not done enough to address it. And so it's just easier to deny the problem. And what I'm hoping comes from this book is that when we start to see the forest, as well as some of the trees that I show through different stories of people who have experienced some form or other of gender violence, that we will see that this is a problem that's affecting all of us. Mm-hmm. And that it's going to take an investment and some courage for all of us to address it.
Do you find redemption in the fact that in your case, there have been some mea culpas? David Brock, for example, wrote the book The Real Anita Hill, which was a bestseller, and totally recanted just about everything in the book. Does that give you any kind of satisfaction?
Well, one of the things that when Brock recanted, one of the things that was made clear by that act was our tendency to believe people, even when they're making up facts to discredit survivors, but also how our institutions can get co-opted and become complicit in the violence. And Brock himself you know, talks about being able to go to the White House and get information and having access to people in power to be able to write a book discrediting me. And so what it revealed to me was the depths in which people will go to. And I mean depths, and I mean the lows that people will go to. And the way that institutions get used to cover bad behavior and to excuse it and actually blame victims. And that's why, you know, people ask, well, why don't women just come forward? Well, there's plenty of evidence of why women don't come forward. There are plenty of evidence of why most victims don't report the bad behavior that they experience, whatever their gender.
As you know, Professor Hill, sometimes despite the evidence, people will believe what they want to believe. And of course, one of those, perhaps not surprisingly, is the wife of Clarence Thomas. And it's one thing to believe it, but she actually made a phone call to you a few years ago. And that was a shocking revelation that she would do that. How did it affect you when you heard her voice on your answering machine?
Well, fortunately, it was a few years ago, and I've had years and years of dealing with people who just are in denial, and hers was another example. But what troubled me about the call was that, you know, that she might still be able to use her power in her position of power as the wife of the Supreme Court Justice against me. That didn't turn out to be the case, that there were no real repercussions because of it. But you see, again, that people who do come forward, even years after, that they can still incur the wrath of people mm-hmm. who want to deny their truth. And so, you know, again, this book is really about how many people are experiencing in some form or another the same kinds of experiences that I had, and how we have to consider all of these because they are linked together. And we also have to consider how race plays a factor and how it played a factor in my situation, but as well as in the data that says that women of color are more likely to be abused, whether it's sexual harassment or rape. And so we've got to deal with a whole lot of cultural issues, and we can't stop there. We've got to look at how our processes, including our criminal justice system and our civil justice system, fail to give us the protections that we need.
The book is Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence, from Anita Hill. A listener asked, did Specter, Senator Specter, who's now dead, or Orrin Hatch, who is still alive, did they ever apologize?
No, there was not an apology from Specter before he died. There was this sort of overture, but it didn't come with an apology. This overture was, well, maybe we could work together on something. But it didn't come with an apology. I've never heard from Orrin Hatch, so I haven't heard any word from him in the past 30 years. And you know, at this point, I'm not looking for apologies. I got a personal apology from President Biden on the eve of his announcement that he was going to be running for president. But what I'm looking for now is for leaders to lead.
Well, thank you, Anita Hill. The book is Believing. Signature support for Talk Louisiana is from First Financial Tax and Accounting.